Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life. My name is Dr. Miriam Nyhan-Gray, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you had a good week. Here at Glucksman Ireland House, we're getting ready for our spring 2020 events, and that lineup of events is gradually being made live on our website, if any of you would like to refer to that. We're kicking off our series with a talk on James Joyce and the Posthumanist Reader by Professor James Ramey on Thursday, January 30th. And then we have a lecture on the 13th of February by Professor Guy Biner, who's going to talk about his award-winning book, Forgetful Remembrance, Social Forgetting and Vernacular Historiography of a Rebellion in Ulster. Professor Biner is a great scholar and he's visiting the United States at the moment, and we're delighted to be welcoming him here to Glucksman Ireland House. For any of you interested in our Blarney Star concert series, that starts on Friday, January 31st at 8 p.m. New Leaf, which is a trio composed of button accordionist John Tabb, fiddler Kira Jewett, and singer multi-instrumentalist Adam Braunschweig. They're going to be here playing as part of the first Blarney Star concert of spring 2020. So lots to look forward to, folks, and I hope you will join us here. I wanted to go into the archive. There's been a lot of talk and activism, thankfully, around some of the anti-Semitic incidents that have taken place in New York in particular, I suppose we're interested in here, but across the world right now, unfortunately. And it made me think of the honour I had in interviewing the Holocaust survivor Tommy Reichenthal a while back, probably in 2018. Tommy has lived in Ireland for many decades. He's a campaigner and Holocaust survivor. And late last year, late in 2019, he was awarded a human rights honour by the organisation representing Ireland's barristers. The Bar of Ireland said the award was in recognition of his work promoting tolerance and in educating young people about the importance of remembrance and reconciliation. And in that vein, I'm delving into the archives to share the interview I conducted with Tommy. Jerry Gregg, the filmmaker, was there with us as we chatted that day, and I hope you'll carefully listen to these important reflections by Tommy. Enjoy, folks. I'm here sitting with Tommy Reichenthal and Jerry Gregg. Thank you for coming to Glucksman Ireland House and welcome. It's a real personal privilege and honour to be here to meet you, Tommy, and also yourself, Jerry. I know you're someone with a distinguished career in filmmaking and directing and writing and stuff like that. So thank you for taking this little sideline trip on your way to Long Island. Maybe Tommy, so ostensibly we're talking about Condemned to Remember, which is your third film with Jerry about your life experiences as a boy. Tommy, could I start off this interview by asking you, can you tell me exactly when and where you were born, and maybe we'll, not to dwell too much on the tough stuff, but just a little bit, what struck me in Condemned to Remember, I watched it yesterday, And what was what's beautiful in the film is seeing where you were born. You know, I think sometimes you say the names of these far-flung places to Irish people and they sound exotic and remote. And where you grew up in Slovakia struck me as like a field or little town or village, like somewhere in anywhere in Ireland. And to see that, to see how Irish people in particular or people from any part of the world might relate to that sense of place and where you come from. So, sorry, my question is to tell us a little bit about when and where you were born and your childhood.
Well, I was born in Slovakia. Mm-hmm. In a town of Pištany, but I grew up in a little village called Merašice. I'm Jewish, of course I'm a Holocaust survivor as well. I found and still remember the village as a little paradise. As a kid, we used to, in summer, go everywhere barefoot, and in winter we used to toboggan in the snow. So I have very fond memory.
And was your father a farmer? Is that right, Tommy?
Well, it was a farming community. About 700 people lived in this village. And my father was a farmer. And my grandfather had a village shop. So we were connected to the village. We were part of the society there. And very much liked. Anybody ever needed any advice, they always would come to my father or grandfather, whether they wanted a good doctor or needed a lawyer or something like this. They always looked for the advice in the Reichenthal family.
So, one of the other things that struck me about Condemned to Remember, Tommy, is, you know, sometimes this implication or portrayal of the Jews as outsiders or, you know, traveler or, you know, that they move from place to place, which I know was part of how, you know, Jewish communities evolved and how Jewish people moved around as merchants or peddlers and different things like that. But from what I can gather, your family was in this little village in Slovakia for hundreds of years.
Absolutely. I could trace the family, not necessarily in this village, mm-hmm. but not far. We lived all in the surrounding area, and I can go to 1917. So, 1700.
Wow.
And so we lived in Slovakia for generations, probably before as well, that I can't go any further. So, yes, we were Slovak first and Jewish second. My father was in the Slovak army. I had relatives. I had one of the uncles. He was one of the first pilots in the Slovak Air Force. So we were Slovak citizens. We considered ourselves Slovak. And suddenly one day we
that
were
changed.
Stranger in our own country.
What would proportion of, say, the little village you grew up in, Merašice, what proportion of that village would have been Jewish, Tommy?
We were the only family.
Oh, you were the only ones.
There were other two families there, but they were converted. They were Jewish, but they converted very early, sometime in the 1920s. So they were converts who could have lived during the period of the Holocaust or the persecution. Because the Slovak government did recognize conversion before 1920.
Mm.
But eventually
it didn't matter,
yeah.
Can you recall to me, Tommy, and this may have been in the earlier films, which I've not had the pleasure is kind of a hard word to apply, but the honour of seeing it. Can you tell me from your recollections as a child, so you were born in 1935, is that right?
1935, yeah.
Do you remember that first instance or moment or occurrence when you realised there was a change in terms of how people perceived you or your family? Is there an example that you can give me in your memory?
Well, the thing was that while it started in Slovakia, which is in 1939, I wasn't told anything. You know, I was 39, I was 4 year old, 1940, 5 year old, 1941, 6. I actually began to see what was happening there in end of 1941, beginning of 1942, because my parents consciously, deliberately didn't tell me anything. In the village, everybody knew us. I didn't feel any difference. The children used to play with me and with my brother. We fitted into the society. The first sign that something was different, and I wouldn't have understood this. For example, when we play football with the football team in the village, the change was very significant, because normally they would call us by name, you know, Tommy, you know. And I was only a kid. I used to be in the team, just sort of very small. My brother is 4 years older, so he would actually be playing in the team, and they would say, pass the ball to Mickey, or that the normal way that you in a game would behave. But then when the situation with the Jews began, suddenly, instead of calling us by name, they would shout, pass the ball to the Jew. I don't know even if it was as a hatred or something, but just we suddenly become different people. And not only that we become different, we didn't want to play with them, because by showing some common friendship or something like that, it would have reflected on them that they are playing with the Jews. So we sort of pulled back, not to get them into trouble.
And this was at age six. You were about 6 years of age when you remember this.
Yeah, these things started about 1941. But for me, I wouldn't have really understood. The first time that I actually understood that I'm different was late in 1941, when we were expelled, of course, from the school, because the Jews were not allowed to go to the national school. We were expelled and we had to go to a neighboring town where I have relatives, and we had to go. There were quite a large Jewish population, about 5,000 people. The name was Nitra, that was the town, and there were Jewish schools, so we were able to go to the Jewish school. And at the time, of course, as Jewish children, we had to wear the yellow star. Mm-hmm. And when you went to the school and you had some children coming opposite you without the yellow star, obviously the Gentile children, they would start to shout at you, you dirty Jew, you smelly Jew. And that was the moment that I realized I'm different. Not what they told me at home. Well, they even didn't tell us in the school, but on the street, you know, around the corner. I would be going home to, I lived with my aunt, and they would confront me. So eventually I used to run all the way to the school and back, and when I saw children on the corner, I would run to the other side of the street, because as time was going on, they become more aggressive. They would want to spit at you, they would throw stone after you, and if they caught you, they beat you up. Mm-hmm. And it happened a couple of times, and I used to come home to my aunt crying, I don't want to go to school, I'm being persecuted, and you know, it was very difficult. I was only 6 years old, little boy. And that was the first time that I really experienced the hatred. And it happened because in 1939, the president of Slovakia, he wasn't elected by people, but they were installed by the German that occupied in 1939 Czech Republic. They are next to Sudetenland, and they imposed this government in Slovakia, which was very anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish. And that's when the trouble started. And the propaganda was spread through the churches, because we didn't have the information system that we have today. So in other words, at the masses, especially in the rural area, I mean, newspaper used to come if somebody passed through the village and they left newspaper, so we heard what is happening outside. People didn't have even radio. If you had radio, you were considered a middle class person. Mm-hmm. So the propaganda was spread through the churches, because the president of Slovakia, his name was Josef Tiso, he was a priest, and he was anti-Semite. He didn't like the Jew. So that's how they, in the rural area, they spread hatreds against the Jews. Slovakia was very Roman Catholic, it's still today, and the people were in the rural area, very simple, good people. But they listened to what the church was telling them. So that's how the hate, little by little,
started.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, Tommy, in terms of, would, and pardon me if my language is not exactly right in this, how observant was your family in terms of the practice of Judaism? And a second question related to that, did your family, did your father, for example, or your mother ever think of converting, or would the fact that you didn't convert, they didn't convert, indicate that they were more religious maybe than the other families? Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's right. Now, my parents, they socialized very much with the local priest. His name was Ladislav Harangozo. He was a good man. He wasn't preaching in the church, hatred against Jews. And he was from Hungarian descent. And my parents were educated in Hungary, so they spoke perfect Hungarian. Now, the language, the Hungarian was prohibited in Slovakia, because Hungary and Slovakia, they were not very good friends. And when Tiso came to power, he broke from Czech Republic, whereas before it was Czechoslovakia. When Czech Republic was occupied by the German, Tiso declared a Republic of Slovakia. And as a Slovak Republic, he prohibited for people speaking Hungarian, because part of Slovakia during the Hungarian, Austro-Hungarian time, they spoke Hungarian in the region. And because Slovakia was not very friendly with Hungary, he prohibited this. So the priest, he could hardly speak to the population. Nobody spoke in Meresztice, Hungarian. So the only people that he had sort of a common language, they used to play cards between my parents and Vladislav, the priest, yeah, Father Harangoso. And he wanted to help us. And he, one time he said to my mother, he said, "Why don't you convert? I will make the conversion, because being Jewish now is very difficult." But many Jews did convert, because the Jewish people did anything to save their lives. Mm-hmm, you know?
Of course.
But of course the loophole of when all this started, a camp when the government declared that we will not recognize any conversion which happened after 1922. Only people that converted before 1922, in other words, they converted of their own will.
Delicious.
And it was significant, because they knew the conversion was only not that the Jewish people wanted to be Catholic, but they want to save their life. So my mother said to Father Harangozo that even if we converted and we were caught, that it wouldn't help us anyway. So that was the reason why we didn't convert. But eventually, actually, Father Harangozo did help us in a way. And this was the very big to show that there you have Joseph Tiso. He was a priest and he was anti-Semite, and what he wanted to do against the Jews. And here you had a priest, Father Harangozo, that wanted to help us. So I actually, at the time when the German, I'm jumping now a little bit, because Slovakia in fact was not occupied by Germany. Whatever happened in Slovakia, sadly, it was the Slovak regime. And they captured the Jews, they passed them to the German, and the German then deported them, and they decimated the entire Jewish population in Slovakia. Slovakia had about 90,000 Jews in 1942, before the deportation started. End of the war, around 15,000-17,000 were left. I lost 35 members of my family. So at the time when Slovakia was occupied by Germany, we had to sort of move from the village, because we didn't know who was our friend, who was our enemy, and we were afraid that somebody will betray us. In fact, why we were not deported from the beginning, because the Jews that were deported were basically Jewish people that were not useful to the government. But because my father was a farmer and producer of food, we got a little document to state that for the time being we shouldn't be deported, because there were two phases in Slovakia of deportation. The first one was in 1942, that started in March 1942 and ended in October 42. So during this time, majority of the Jews of Slovakia were arrested and deported, and most of them perished. But then in 1944, in August, there was an uprising in Slovakia against the regime, because the Tiso regime not only harmed the Jews, but the Slovak people suffered as well. Anybody that didn't belong to the party was being arrested. Anybody that spread a rumor against the government was being arrested and sometimes never seen again. So the Slovak people rebelled. There was a rebellion, and that was the time that Germany occupied Slovakia, not because they wanted to occupy Slovakia, but because they wanted to save the friendly regime of Joseph Tiso. He was a fascist, and he sympathized with the Nazis. He helped them. There was cooperation. And once this happened, we knew our paper, our thing won't be what the paper it was written on, and therefore we had to clear from the village. My father stayed because, as a farmer, you know, he had to look after the livestock, after the field and everything. And my mother, my brother and myself, we were going to go to another place to live and pretend that we were Gentiles. And Father Harangozo was the person that provided us with false paper. So my name wasn't Tommy Reichenthal, my name was Thomas Vida. Mm. Vida was a typical Slovak name, because with a document with the name Reichenthal, it's a German name. But we were not German, so they would have known right away we were Jewish. So we were able to travel, you know, then we were stopped on the train and we had to identify ourselves. No problem, you know. And this was something that that Father Harangozo gave us, this paper, helping us. And not only this, he said that, you know, when you're going to this new place to live, the children will have to go to the school, because we were not going to school anymore. We were, you know, when the deportation started, our teachers were taken away. So the school closed, and the Jewish school closed, and we couldn't go to national school. So for years we didn't go to school. But Father Harango said, if you come now to this new place you're going to pretend that you are Gentiles, the children will have to go to the school, otherwise they will be asking why they're not going to school. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to school and you don't know anything about the religion, they will be suspicious right away. So he took us in, and we used to go for about 2 weeks, and he taught us how to pray the prayers that the children were praying before the class started, about the various holidays in the Catholic calendar, about the station of the cross. Mm-hmm. And we had to learn how to grace ourselves, cross ourselves, and all these little things. So when they were talking about it in the class, we were not totally ignorant. Unfortunately, it didn't come to us. We were arrested. We were betrayed.
I'll intervene here. That's all in Tommy War. That's all. You get a load of that into the 10th generation. Okay. And you get the tribute to the priest. You get the tribute to the priest as well.
Okay.
And we have with the papers and everything. And put his own life at risk.
Right. Yeah. And so were your parents quite religious? You know, outside of the whole consideration?
My grandfather was very religious.
On your father's side or your mother's side?
My father's side.
Okay.
My father was religious, but then my mother and we were a little bit, we maintained the tradition, and we wouldn't show anything that my grandfather would see that we're doing something that we're not supposed to. do. So when there was Sabbath, you know, you're not allowed to run, or you're not allowed to write. All these things, we didn't do it. When he was around, we wouldn't dare to do things like this, because
he was... But if he wasn't there, it was more relaxed.
Well, it was...
Do you recall, Tommy, I know this is a kind of a random question, but say, for example, and I know you didn't have school for long periods of time in that period for the reasons you outlined, do you remember ever hearing about Ireland as a child?
No, but I mean, if you, this is an interesting question, because I recall when I was in London before I came to Ireland, and my uncle was in London, and when you were in a restaurant and there was a waitress and she spoke English, he would know from the dialect that she was Irish, and he said, "See this lovely girl, she's Irish, you know." And it never struck me that it's like England and Ireland are totally two different states. At the time, we didn't have internet, or we didn't have, that you could send a letter through the computer and messages, you know. So I used to write every week to my parents. They lived in Israel, and I used to send a letter. So I had a booklet of English stamp. So when I came to Ireland, I continued to write every week. So the first week I wrote a letter, of course, I put the English stamp on, and I go to GPO, have my letter in my hand, to post it. And suddenly a lady saw me, and you know, at the time there was a little bit of trouble in Ireland. They didn't like very much the English. And she saw my letter with the Queen on the stamp, you know, and she said, I could hardly, at the time, I didn't speak English, very little, like a couple of, and she said, "This is Ireland. The Queen, no, you know." So when I even came to Ireland, I thought Ireland was England.
Right.
I never heard about Ireland. Incredible.
So when you, and I know we're...
Unfortunately, Ireland became famous when the troubles were, but the modern
beforehand.
Trouble, not the 1916.
Yeah, the more modern stuff. Yeah. But so can you tell me why, Tommy, why Ireland in 1959? You know, there are like Jewish refugees in... As you say, you've an uncle in London, there are lots here in New York, Paris, I mean, all the major cities after the war. Why Ireland?
Well, I wasn't a refugee when I came to Ireland. I actually, it's a long story, I don't know if you want me to go through it. But basically, English industrialist that manufactures zips, he wanted to set up a factory in Ireland. And in this household, my cousin was an au pair girl. And he was advertising in a newspaper to get a manager to set up a factory in Ireland to manufacture zips. And he couldn't get in. First, he advertised in Ireland. Don't forget, in the late 50s, it's not Ireland of today.
Yeah,
it
no.
was a different country, and I can testify really the huge change that happened in Ireland. But he couldn't get anybody to do it, so he advertised in English paper.
And you were living in London?
No.
Where were you?
I was studying in German.
Oh, wow.
I studied engineering, and I qualified as a diploma engineer, not thinking about Ireland or London or anything. And my cousin spotted this ad in the paper. And very innocently, she went to her boss and she said, "You know, you are going to have a competition in Ireland because somebody's wants to set up a factory to manufacture zip, and he was the biggest manufacturer of zips in England. He was a big industrialist. And she said, why you think I will have competition? He said, well, I read this ad, and she showed him in the newspaper that somebody is looking for a manager to set up this factory there. And he said, I won't have any competition. I put the ad in the paper. And he said, what? He said, I can't get anybody. So she said to him, I have a cousin. He's just finishing college in Germany. He's an engineer, diploma engineer. Maybe he will be interested. And the next thing, I get a letter from this gentleman with an airline ticket to London, and he inviting me that he has a proposition to for me. And if we can do business, good. If we can't do business, I will have a holiday on his account.
Mm-hmm.
I was at the time 23, 24 year old. So, of course, it was a great adventure for me to go to London. So I went to London, and we talked 2 days, and we signed a contract, and I agreed what he wanted to do. He will send me to Italy, where he will order the machinery and everything. I will learn how to manufacture zip, because I didn't know anything about the zip, but of course I was an engineer. And then I go to Ireland and build a factory for him there. And at the time, this why I mentioned it before, in Ireland there were no foreigner, because in Ireland was a huge unemployment in the 1960s, 23%, 24%.
And everybody was leaving.
Yeah, well, I don't know if he was leaving, but the government wouldn't allow anybody to come to Ireland because they didn't want to
take
the jobs, you know. So when my boss applied for me to get a permit, it took 8 months.
Wow.
I was sitting in Italy having a good time while I was waiting and getting wages and everything, waiting to
get
a permit. And eventually I got it, because obviously he told them that he's not coming to take a job, he's going to create a job. You know, at the time the labor was much cheaper than in England, so it suited him to set up a factory in Ireland at that time. And
John Lamass. John, the great opening up, the beginnings of the opening up of the Irish economy. And guys like Tommy were needed, entrepreneurs. In his case, this brilliant skills at putting together machines, making those machines run, making those machines make things. So Tommy is a product of that change of Whittaker and Lamass opening up Ireland to foreign industry and investment. That's how we come in.
And while I was setting the factory and everything, I met a Jewish girl in Ireland. We fell in love. Got married, and still today. But it's not choice. My wife died in 2003. She had a cancer. I was left on my own. And 3 years later, I met Joyce. And in 2006, and since then,
that's great.
Very lucky.
That's
she's
wonderful.
A lovely lady,
and it keeps you young.
Yeah.
I always encourage that when people lose their partner. Now, just a sidebar. I knew you had spent some time in Germany, but I didn't register then. Had you any hesitation in going to study in Germany so soon after what you'd been through at the hands of the Germans?
Well, at the time, I was living in Israel at the time. I lived in Israel 13 years. I was in the Israeli army. I was in the Suez campaign, where I had to defend my life for the second time. And after the army, I wanted to learn well, I was working as an engineer, but I wanted a qualification, and I knew the best qualification as engineer I will get in Germany, and that was of course in the 50s. This was only 10 years after I come from the concentration camps. You can imagine in Israel they said, how of all countries you choose to go to Germany? So of course the reason was what the reason was, but I said at the time there was great cooperation between Israel and Germany. Adenauer was the president, and Ben Gurion
he was chancellor,
yeah, and Ben Gurion, they were very good friends, and Germany helped awful lot for Israel, and they supply equipment and all kind of cooperation. And when Ben Gurion was going on an official visit anywhere, the side drivers, you know, the police, used to drive the BMW motorbike, and they would go on each side. And I used to say, well, if Ben Gurion can be accompanied by two German motorbikes, I can go to Germany and learn. That was my
rationale.
Reasoning.
That's very good. That's very good. I gather, Tommy, that basically for over five decades you didn't talk about your experiences, and you know, I mean, it's obvious why on one level that would be the case. And it was an instance where your grandson asked you to talk about your experience in school that kind of opened things up. So am I correct in thinking, I think you mentioned either in something I read or in, I think it was in something I read, that you had never spoken to your late wife about it. So then would I assume that when they were children, you didn't talk to your children about it?
I didn't. My wife passed away, as I mentioned, in 2003. She knew I was a Holocaust survivor, but I never told her what I went through. I just didn't speak to anybody. My employees, when I was working, I had my own business, they didn't know. When suddenly I come out with it, he said, Tommy,
You never told us
about this thing. I said, I couldn't. When my wife passed away, I decided to retire because, I said to myself, who I'm working for? Mm-hmm. Thank God my children, they had all very good jobs, they settled. I have no wife, and I have enough for myself, you know, I don't need to work. But after a couple of days, weeks, I couldn't sit around and watch television or thing. I started to write for the first time about my experiences, and I wrote a couple of articles for magazines, and then the media came up to me, and Holocaust Education Trust, the people mm-hmm. that I'm still working with today, they come and they wanted to hear what I... So I realized that I'm one of the last witnesses mm-hmm. to this crime that was committed during the Holocaust. I lost 35 members of my family from my mother's side and my father's side. People that I knew, cousins that I used to play with, I still remember them mm-hmm. today. It's incredible. When we meet, like the family, we're still talking about it like they were among us still mm-hmm. today. And one day we said goodbye to them, we never saw them again. Mm-hmm. So I thought I owe it to the victim that the memory is not mm-hmm. forgotten. Mm-hmm. And the thing I say today, I didn't speak for 55 years, but now they can't stop me speaking.
I know. Well, I'm so glad that you are. I wrote down the quote from Condemned to Remember. I had to tell my story. I am part of history. I was there. That's important. We have to be careful that it does not repeat itself. It's just so important in these times we live in, and kind of scary that there's that sense of, on some levels as well. Can I ask you, Tommy, before we bring Jerry into the conversation as well, you know, so I got, would I be correct in thinking then your late wife was from that older Jewish community that had been in Ireland maybe over a longer period of time, obviously, than yourself?
Yeah, she was born in Ireland. Mm-hmm. My father-in-law, he grew up in London, and my mother-in-law, she was Irish, she was born in Ireland as well, and they come from somewhere, from Lithuania or something, mm-hmm. In the early years, mm-hmm. but my wife was born in Dublin.
So from your experiences, Tommy, just wait for that, that's very loud. That's the New York soundscape.
The Vimeos will definitely help you as well if you want to take some audio.
Yeah, out of it, you're right.
Because a lot of that is in there.
Yeah, great, yeah, great. Would you say, Tommy, the Jewish community in Dublin, as you've observed it, or you know, been part of it over the last, since 1959 or so, in as much as you have been, I guess is different to the London Jewish communities or New York or the Parisian and stuff like that. Have you any observations on that?
The main observation is that when I came to Ireland, there were between 5,000-6,000 Jews living in Ireland. Today, they're probably less than 1,000.
Wow.
But basically what happened, the young people, young Jewish people, they grew up together. So when they wanted to get the partners, wives, husbands, they went to Manchester, to Israel, to various other places. And of course, when they set up families and their children, the parents suddenly wanted to be with their grandchildren. Our friends, we have several friends that we were mixing and sort of being, going out. And they all left there. One is in Manchester, one is in London. Because they wanted to be with their children, mm-hmm. with their grandchildren. So Ireland is losing a lot of the Jewish community in the last couple of years.
Did you, you know, Ireland hadn't responded so generously to the plight of Jews in the World War II period. Did you have a sense of that when you came to Ireland, and how did you feel about that?
Well, the Condemned to Remember is a product of what happened. And, of course, I saw the picture when we were... The film started as a continuation of Close to Evil, which was the film before. And we thought that there will be a trial, and we thought we have a story to finish, because in the last film we didn't manage to finish that, because it's still the files from the court was open and everything. So, but of course it didn't happen. And at the time, as we were in Europe filming the film, I said to Jerry, I said, Jerry, you see what is happening today? I can compare it to late 1939, mm-hmm. when the Jewish people wanted to escape the Nazi regime and the persecution that was happening. Nobody wanted them. Among them, of course, was Ireland. They didn't want to take any Jews. And today we have these refugees. They are also persecuted, murdered, raped, and they're trying to find a sanctuary somewhere. They're not coming only to better their life. They want to save themselves, and nobody wants them. It's history repeating itself. And it didn't take long, 70 years. And again, we have a situation. Then, of course, in the film, you can see Srebrenica, what happened in Srebrenica. Didn't happen in 1945. It happened in 1995. In Central Europe, in the civilized society, we can't say anymore, never again. It did happen again. And it's anything can happen. So that's why we did the film. And that's why we call it Condemned to Remember. I can remember and parallel these two events. So it's very frightening time today. The anti-Semitism is on the rise. The racism is on the rise. The right-wing elements are catching places in the government and in my own country, Slovakia, where I come from. There are new party, Our Slovakia, and they're marching on the street and shouting Slovakia for Slovak. It's the same slogan they were shouting in the 40s.
That's one of the things that's so powerful, and I think why it's so important for young people to see Condemned to Remember, which is a nice way for us to segue. Jerry,
Miriam, if you had a few questions, can I be cheeky for a moment?
Yeah.
If you want to, if you have it, the wherewithal to put us into the Uber,
yeah,
send us into the Uber out. I can tell Dave. If you wish to continue with Tommy for a moment.
To Uber out from here, the train.
Have you got the resources for that?
Oh yeah, that's actually easier. Let me do that. Yeah, but I'll still let you go around the same time because
you could then extend it a bit. You can see he's a gold mine.
Yeah, but I'll do that anyway, Jerry. We'll do that anyway. I actually didn't think of that earlier. That's a good idea.
Because it gives you an extra half an hour.
Yeah.
And I'll tell Dave Hannigan not to wait for us at Ronkonkoma, but they give me the location.
Tell him the address to send you to, and I'll put you into it.
Yeah.
Will I press pause here then? Or will I chat away to Tommy?
Chat away to Tommy and I'll go out. Well, I'll look that in.
Yeah. Are you okay, Tommy, or do you need to take a break? You're good.
Okay, no problem.
Yeah, that's easier. Yeah, no, that is much easier. I should have thought of that myself.
I'm a producer.
Yeah. Glad we have you. Yeah, I'm glad we're getting this on tape here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess I'll bring Jerry back in then when he comes in. So do you, have you, like, one thing that strikes me, Tommy, about what you say is, you know, as a child, you know, you considered yourself Slovak first and then that you were Jewish, you know, you know, with your own children, are your children, you know, they self-identify as being Irish and Jewish at the same time, in the same way as maybe that you saw your identity as a child?
I can't say it. One of my sons, it's an American citizen. He lives in California, in near San Francisco. He's an information officer of Palo Alto City.
Oh, wow.
He has a great position here. Other one, he lives in Luton, in England.
Oh, wow.
And that three of them, of course, are Irish. But they're living away. Only one, the eldest one, lives in Dublin.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you were quite happy, though, to make your life in Ireland.
Oh, more than happy.
I
love Ireland.
So, yeah, so like...
I remember when my wife passed away, my father-in-law came to me and he said, "Well, Tommy, I suppose you will now leave and go to live in Israel, where most of my family are living." And of course, my father and mother passed away since. But it would have made sense because I haven't got any family except my own family. Mm-hmm. And nobody in Ireland.
Except your son. Right?
Yeah, well, I'm my own family, mm-hmm. that it's thing. Mm-hmm. They were all from my wife's family that I had. And I said to my father-in-law, "Why? This is my country now. I love Ireland. I will stay here till I'm gone." Mm-hmm. It's I find Ireland, the people. I mean, I travel awful lot, and of course I speak in schools, colleges, private events, in historical society, and all kind of people. Anybody that invites me and wants to hear my story, it's very important. I consider it as something that I have to do, so that as many people as possible hear my story, and that Holocaust is not forgotten, because when we are all gone, survivor and perpetrator as well, we will have all these deniers will come up and say the Holocaust never happened. Mm-hmm. And I always say, anybody that heard me, anybody that saw me, they would be not able to tell them that the Holocaust never happened, because they will be able to say it did happen. Mm-hmm. We saw a person that was there, he spoke to us, and it is a fact, and therefore, I speak any group, whether they're 30 people, 300 or 1,000 people. I spoke so far in Ireland alone, but I travel all over the world. Mm-hmm. This must be my fourth, fifth trip to U.S., mm-hmm. you know, I was in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, and into California, here in New York. I spoke in a couple of colleges as well. In Ireland, I spoke to over 500 schools, to over 100,000 students. Mm-hmm. And they told their parents, and they told their friends. So a lot of people know my story in Ireland.
We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to this Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records.